Chapter 19. Pond Water. The common room was empty at that hour, though the clatter of pots and the murmur of voices through the kitchen door told of preparations for breakfast. She hurried out through a side door into the inn's stable yard. Unseen, she was sure. So far, so good. The sky was just beginning to turn grey, and the air retained every ounce of the night's chill, but at least the rain had stopped. There was a weave to keep rain off, but it did tend to attract notice. Gathering her skirts and cloak to keep them out of the puddles on the paving stones, she quickened her step. The faster gone, the less chance of being seen. Not that she could avoid every eye. The hinges creaked softly as she opened one of the stable doors to slip inside, and the coatless groom on night duty jumped to his feet from the stool, where he had no doubt been dozing with his back against a thick roof post. A skinny, hook-nosed fellow with the tilted eyes of Saldea, he raked his fingers through his hair in a useless effort to straighten it, and made a jerky bow.
"How may I help, my lady?"
he asked in a raspy voice. "Saddle my mare, Kazin," she said, putting a silver penny in his ready hand. It was very good luck that this same man had been on duty when she arrived, too. Master Helvin had written a description of Arrow in the stable book, sitting on a slanted ledge by the doors, but she very much doubted Kazin could read. The silver had him knuckling his forehead and scurrying for Arrow's stall. Likely he more often received coppers. She regretted leaving her pack-horse behind, but not even a fool noble, she had heard Kazin mutter,
"Who but a fool noble would ride out at this hour?"
would take a pack-animal for a morning jaunt. At best, he would hurry inside to find out whether she was paid in full with the innkeeper. She was, and for another night besides, but there was always the chance Cadswain had promised the servants rewards to watch her movements. In the Green Sister's place, she would have. This way, no one would suspect anything until she failed to return that night. Climbing into Arrow's high-cantled saddle, she gave the groom a cool smile because of his comment, and rode slowly out into damp, nearly empty streets. Just out for a ride, however early. It looked to be a good day. The sky looked rained out, for one thing, with barely a cloud blocking the stars, and there was little wind. The lamps high on the walls of every building were still lit all along the streets and alleys, leaving no more than the palest shadow anywhere, yet the only people to be seen were the night watch's helmeted patrols, with their halberds and crossbows, and the lamplighters, just as heavily armed as they made their rounds to make sure no lamp went out. A wonder that people could live so close to the blight that a murdral could step out of any dark shadow. Night watchmen and lamplighters alike eyed her with surprise as she rode by. No one went out in the night. Not in the borderlands. Which was why she was surprised to see she was not the first to reach the western gates. Slowing Arrow, she stayed well back from the three very large men waiting with a pack-horse behind their mounts. None wore helmet or armor, but each wore a sword at his hip and carried a heavy horse-bow with a bristling quiver tied in front of his saddle. Few men went unarmed in these lands. Their attention was all on the barred gates, with now and again a word shared with the gate guards. They seemed impatient for the gates to open and barely glanced in her direction. The lamps near the gates showed their faces clearly. A grizzled old man and a hard-faced young one in dark, knee-long coats with braided leather cords tied around their heads. Malchieri? She thought that was what that cord meant. The third was an Arafelin with belled braids, in a dark yellow coat sewn with more bells, the same fellow she had seen leaving the gates of heaven. By the time a bright sliver of sunrise on the horizon allowed the gates to be swung wide, several merchants' trains had lined up to depart. The three men were first through, but Moiraine let a dozen tall, canvas-covered wagons behind six-horse teams rumble ahead of her, with their outriding guards in helmets and breastplates, before she followed across the bridge and onto the road through the hills. She kept the three in sight, though. They were heading in the same direction so far, after all. They moved quickly, good riders who barely shifted a rein, but speed suited her. The more distance she put between herself and Cadswain, the better. She stayed only close enough to maintain sight of the men. No need to attract their attention until she wished. At that pace, the merchants' wagons and their guards fell behind long before she saw the first village near midday, a small cluster of tile-roofed two-story stone houses around a tiny inn on a forested hill slope beside the road. Even after several months, it still seemed odd to see villagers wearing swords, and at least one halberd racked outside every door. Crossbows and quivers, too. It made stark contrast to the children rolling hoops and tossing beanbags in the street. The three men never slowed or turned an eye toward the village, but Moiraine paused long enough to purchase part of a loaf of crusty pale bread and a narrow wedge of hard yellow cheese, and ask whether anyone knew a woman named Aveen Sahira. The answer was no, and she galloped on until the three appeared on the hard-packed road ahead, their horses still in that ground-eating pace. Maybe they knew nothing more than the name of the sister the Arafelin had spoken to, but anything at all she learned about Cadswain or the other two would be to the good. She formulated several plans for approaching them, and discarded each. Three men on a deserted forest road could well decide a young woman alone was a heaven-sent opportunity, especially if they were what she feared. Handling them presented no difficulty if it came to that, but she wanted to avoid that. Should they turn out to be dark friends or simply brigands, she would have to hold them prisoner long enough to hand them over to some authority. No telling how long that would take, and besides, there would be no hiding that she was Aes Sedai then. News of a woman capturing three outlaws, hardly an event of every day, would spread like wildfire in dry timber. She might as well weave a great column of fire above her head to help anyone who wanted to find her. Forest gave way to scattered farms, and farms faded to more forest, towering fir and pine and leather leaf, massive oaks with only tiny red leaf buds on their thick branches. A red-crested eagle soared overhead not 20 paces up and became a shape against the descending sun. The road ahead was empty except for the three men and their pack animal, and bare of life behind as well. Decent people would be at their suppers. Not that there was so much as a farmhouse in evidence here. As her shadow stretched out behind her, she decided to forget the men and begin looking for a place to sleep. With luck, she might see more farms soon, and if a little silver did not bring a bed, a hayloft would have to do. Without luck, her saddle would suffice for a pillow, if a hard one. A meal would be nice, though. That bread and cheese seemed a very long way back. Ahead, the three men suddenly stopped in the middle of the road, conferring for a moment. She drew rein where she was. Even if they noticed, proper caution for a woman alone called on her not to ride up on them. Then one of the fellows took the pack horse and turned aside into the forest. The others dug in their heels and rode on at a quicker pace, as though suddenly remembering somewhere they needed to be. Moiraine frowned. The Arafelin was one of the pair rushing off, but since they were traveling together, maybe he had mentioned meeting an Aes Sedai to his companion left behind. The younger Malkieri, she thought. People did talk about encounters of that sort. Relatively few people had actually met a sister and known who or what she was, and one man would certainly be less trouble than three, if she was careful. Riding to where rider and pack horse had vanished, she dismounted and began searching for sign. Most ladies left tracking to their huntsmen, but she had taken an interest in the years when climbing trees and getting dirty had seemed equal fun. It appeared this man was no woodsman, though. Broken twigs and kicked winterfall leaves left a trail a child could have followed. 100 paces or so into the forest, she spotted a wide pond in a hollow through the trees, and the younger of the Malkieri. He had already unsaddled and hobbled his bay, a fine-looking animal, much too fine for his worn coat, perhaps the sign of a bandit, and was setting the pack saddle on the ground. He looked even larger this close, with very wide shoulders and a narrow waist. Far from a pretty man, too. Not unhandsome, with that hard, angular face. A suitable face for a brigand. Unbuckling his sword belt, he sat down cross-legged facing the pond, laid sword and belt beside him, and put his hands on his knees. He seemed to be staring off across the water, still glittering through the late afternoon shadows, toward the water reeds that rimmed the far bank. He did not move a muscle. Moiraine considered. Plainly, he had been left to make camp. The others would return, but not quickly, since he was slacking his task. A question or two would not take long. Which of you met an Aes Sedai recently might be enough. And if he was unnerved a little, say it finding her suddenly standing right behind him, he might answer before he thought. Saidar must be left till last. She would have to use it almost certainly, but let the fact that she could channel come as an added surprise. Tying Arrow's reins to a low branch on a leather leaf, she gathered her cloak and skirts and moved forward as silently as possible. A small hummock lay behind him, and she stepped up onto that. Added height could help. He was a very tall man. And it might also help if he found her with her belt knife in one hand and his sword in the other. Channeling, she whisked the scabbarded blade from his side. Every little bit of shock she could manage for him. He moved faster than thought. No one so large could move so fast, yet her grasp closed on the scabbard and he uncoiled, whirling, one hand clutching the scabbard between hers, the other seizing the front of her dress. Before she could think to channel, she was flying through the air. She had just time to see the pond coming up at her, just time to shout something she did not know what, and then she struck the surface flat, driving all the wind out of her, struck with a great splash and sank. The water was freezing! Saidar fled in her shock. Floundering to her feet, she stood up to her waist in the icy water, coughing, wet hair clinging to her face, sodden cloak dragging at her shoulders. Furiously, she twisted around to confront her attacker, furiously embraced the source once more, prepared to knock him down and drub him till he squealed. He stood, shaking his head and frowning in puzzlement at the spot where she had stood, a long stride from where he had been sitting. She might as well have been a fish. When he deigned to notice her, he put down the scabbarded sword and came to the edge of the pond, bending to stretch out a hand.
"Unwise to try separating a man from his sword," he said, and after a glance at the colored slashes on her dress, added, "My lady."
Hardly an apology. His startlingly blue eyes did not quite meet hers. If he was hiding mirth.
Muttering under her breath, she splashed awkwardly to where she could take his outstretched hand in both of hers, and heaved with all of her might. Ignoring icy water trickling down your ribs was not easy, and if she was wet, so would he be, and without any need to use the one. He straightened, raised his arm, and she came out of the water dangling from his hand. In consternation, she stared at him until her feet touched the ground and he backed away.
"I'll start a fire and hang out blankets so you can dry yourself," he murmured, still not meeting her gaze.
What was he hiding? Or perhaps he was shy? She had never heard of a shy, dark friend, though she supposed there could be some. He was as good as his word, and by the time the other men reappeared, she was standing beside a small fire surrounded by blankets dug from his pack saddles and hung from the branches of an oak. She had no need of the fire for drying, of course. The proper weave of water had taken every drop from her hair and clothes while she stayed in them. As well he did not see that, though, or her, until her hair was combed straight and brushed. And she did appreciate the flame's warmth. Anyway, she had to stay inside the blankets long enough for the man to think she had used the fire as he intended. She very definitely held on to Saidar. So far, she had proof of nothing.
"Did she follow you, Lan?"
a man's voice said as he dismounted to the jingle of bells.
"The Arafelin."
"Why are those blankets up?"
a sour voice demanded gruffly. Moiraine stared at nothing, missing what reply her assailant made to the questions. They had known? Men watched for bandits in these times, but they had noticed a lone woman and decided she was following them? It made no sense. But why lure her into the woods instead of just confronting her? Three men had no reason to fear one woman. Unless they knew she was Aes Sedai, they would step very cautiously then. But she was certain the fellow had no idea how she had gotten hold of his sword.
A Kyrianin, Lan? I suppose you've seen a Kyrianin in her skin, but I never have.
That certainly caught her ear, and with the power filling her, so did another sound. Steel whispering on leather. A sword leaving its sheath. Preparing several weaves that would stop the lot of them in their tracks, she made a crack in the blankets to peek out. To her surprise, the man who had dunked her, Lan, stood with his back to her blankets. He was the one with bared steel in hand. The Arafelan facing him looked surprised.
"You remember the sight of the Thousand Lakes, Rhine," Lan said coldly. "Does a woman need protection from your eyes?"
For a moment she thought Rhine was going to draw despite the blade already in Lan's hand, but the older man, Bukama, she heard him called, a much battered graying fellow, though as tall as the others, calmed matters, took the other two a little distance away with talk of some game called Sevens. A strange game it seemed to be, and more than dangerous in the failing daylight. Lan and Rhine sat cross-legged, facing one another, their swords sheathed, then without warning drew, each blade flashing toward the other man's throat, stopping just short of flesh. The older man pointed to Rhine. They sheathed swords and then did it again. For as long as she watched, that was how it went. Perhaps Rhine had not been so overconfident as he seemed. Waiting inside the blankets, she tried to recall what she had been taught of Malkyr. It had not been a great deal, except as history. Rhine remembered the Thousand Lakes, so he must be Malkyrie too. There had been something about distressed women. Now that she was with them, she might as well stay until she learned what she could. When she came out from behind the blankets, she was ready. "I claim the right of a woman alone," she told them formally. "I travel to Chachin, and I ask the shelter of your swords." She also pressed a fat silver coin into each man's hand. She was not really sure about this ridiculous woman alone business, but silver caught most men's attention. And two more each, paid in Chachin. The reactions were not what she expected. Rhine glared at the coin as he turned it over in his fingers. Lan looked at his without expression and tucked it into his coat pocket with a grunt. She had given them some of her last Tarvalen marks, she realized, but Tarvalen coins could be found anywhere, along with those of every other land. Bukama bowed with his left hand on his knee.
"Honored to serve, my lady," he said. "To Chachin, my life above yours."
His eyes were also blue, and they too would not quite meet hers. She hoped he did not turn out to be a dark friend. Learning anything proved to be difficult. Impossible. First, the men were busy setting up camp, tending the horses, making a larger fire. They did not seem eager to face a new spring night without that. Bukama and Lan barely said a word over a dinner of flat bread and dried meat that she tried not to wolf down. Rhine talked, and was quite charming, really, with a dimple in his cheek when he smiled and a sparkle in his blue eyes, but he gave no opening for her to mention the gates of heaven or Aes Sedai. When she finally inquired why he was going to Chachin, his face turned sad.
"Every man has to die somewhere," he said softly, and went off to make up his blankets.
A very odd answer, worthy of an Aes Sedai. Lan took the first watch as the moon rose above the trees, sitting cross-legged not far from Rhine. And when Bukama doused the fire and rolled himself up in his blankets near Lan, she wove a ward of spirit around each man. Flows of spirit she could hold on to sleeping, and if any of them moved in the night, the ward would wake her without alerting them. It meant waking every time they changed guard, which they did frequently, but there was nothing for it. Her own blankets lay well away from the men, and as she settled her head on her saddle for the third time, Bukama murmured something she could not catch. She heard Lan's reply plainly enough.
"I'd sooner trust an Aes Sedai, Bukama. Go to sleep."
All the anger she had tamped down flared up. The man threw her into an icy pond. He did not apologize. She channeled air and water weaving with a touch of earth. A thick cylinder of water rose from the surface of the pond, stretching up and up in the moonlight, arching over, crashing down on the fool who was so free with his tongue. Splattered, Bukama and Rhine bounded to their feet with oaths, but she continued the torrent for a count of 10 before letting it end. Freed water splashed down across the campsite. She expected to see a sodden, half-frozen man beaten to the ground and ready to learn proper respect. He was dripping wet, a few small fish flopping around his feet. He was standing on his feet, with his sword out.
"Shadow spawn?" Rhine said in a disbelieving tone,
and atop him, Lan said,
"Maybe. I've never heard the like, though. Guard the woman, Rhine. Bukama, take west and circle south. I'll take east and circle north."
"Not shadow spawn,"
Moiraine snapped, stopping them in their tracks. They stared at her. She wished she could see their expressions better in the moon shadows, but those cloud-shifting shadows aided her, too, cloaking her in mystery. With an effort, she gave her voice every bit of cool Aes Sedai serenity she could muster. "It is unwise to show anything except respect to an Aes Sedai, Master Lan."
"Aes Sedai?"
Rhine whispered. Despite the dim light, the awe on his face was clear. Or maybe it was fear. No one else made a sound, except for Bukama's grumbles as he shifted his bed away from the mud. Rhine spent a long time moving his blankets in silence, giving her small bows whenever she glanced his way. Lan made no attempt to dry off. He started to choose a new spot for his watch, then stopped and sat back where he had been, in the mud and water. She might have thought it a gesture of humility, only he glanced at her, very nearly meeting her eyes this time. If that was humility, kings were the most humble men on earth. She wove her wards around them again, of course. If anything, revealing herself only made it more necessary. She did not go to sleep for quite a while, though. She had a great deal to think about. For one thing, none of the men had asked why she was following them. The man had been on his feet. When she drifted off, she was thinking of Rhine, strangely. A pity if he was afraid of her now. A great pity if he turned out to be a dark friend. He was charming and quite pretty, really. She did not mind a man wanting to see her unclothed, only his telling others about it.